sound like you had a pretty damn good time.
All right.
Can I start?
Okay, great. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening.
It's great to be here in Hartsa Memorial Hall, the Grand Army of the Republic. I'd like to dedicate tonight's lecture to two people. First of all, late meteorologist Don Kent, and to General George Hartsuff. General, thank you for allowing me to use your building here today. Special thanks goes out to the Rockland Historical Commission and the Hartsuff Memorial Association for having me here in this fine town of Rockland. Well, tonight we're going to talk about one of my most popular lectures, the Great Hurricane of 1938. I've been called a lot of things, some that I can't say in public, but a historical raconteur, New England folklorist. But one of my passions is historical meteorology. And if we look back at what's been called Long Island Express GH-38, it's the last great hurricane to strike New England. I'm also into historical astronomy. And I must say, going into this talk, we're in very strange times indeed. I can't pronounce the name of the volcano in Iceland. I call it Ike or Big E. But there are some eerie parallels with what's going on today with our weather, mainly a volcano going off and a lack of sunspot activity that parallels with the year without a summer, another lecture that I do, which dropped worldwide global temperatures. And then the other strange thing is Heather Locklear is back behind the wheel, which scares all of us. I'm also a professional sports announcer, so if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice, I'm an announcer for the Boston Bruins alumni, 18 years, and I'm the New England Patriots basketball announcer, if you can comprehend that. So. Rules of engagement, cell phones off, please. Usually when I say that, my wife calls me. Mine's still on, so restrooms right over here in case of fire, straight out the back, follow the exit signs. And of course, the expert rule, and it certainly applies here, although I'm a bit disappointed because I don't see anybody in the room tonight that was around in 1938. You're all too young for me. But there's usually someone in the room who knows more about the subject than I do, and someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. But of course, in this case, most of you, if you've experienced it, I want to hear about your personal recollections at the conclusion of tonight's talk. So we're going to talk about what is a hurricane, take a snapshot of the GH-38 and some of the factoids, a history of North Atlantic hurricanes. We're going to look at the other two great hurricanes in addition to the Great Hurricane of 1938. That's the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635 and the Great September Gale of 1815. We'll look at the track of the hurricane, the summer of 38, a muffed forecast, a record low air pressure. They're insane, some of these numbers you're going to see tonight. New York City, we're going to follow the path of the hurricane. New York City, Long Island, Connecticut, the Great New London Fire, Rhode Island. A couple of stories, personal stories. One I call Wedding Splashers, the Mary Poppins of Brent Rock. We'll briefly look at the Great Flood of 36, and then the battering of the Connecticut River Valley, the impact, and then the death of a monster. With this hurricane, you see acts of bravery and cowardice, acts of kindness and selfishness, providence, luck, and cruel fate. Up until that time, this was the most costly disaster in U.S. history. It was a lateral buzzsaw, my term. Nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. There were unlikely heroes, and by the time this thing died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. Now to get into some hurricane talk, but you hear Category 1 through Category 5. Basically, Category 1 is wind speeds of 75 miles per hour to 74 miles per hour to 95 miles per hour, all the way up to a Cat 5, which is greater than 155 miles per hour, almost incomprehensible. Storm surge, the reason why I bring this up, let me go back to that slide. We're talking about a tropical depression with 23 to 39 miles per hour. We've had how many of those? 10 already in the last 6 months. A tropical storm, 40 to 73 miles per hour. Well, the last major hit we had was Hurricane Bob of August of 1991, and that was just a hiccup next to the Great Hurricane of 1938. But it devastated the lower canal on the south coast of Massachusetts. It looked like F-16s moved in on sorties with some of the destruction in Wareham and Swift Beach that I got to witness firsthand. If you look at hurricane damage, you're talking about storm surge. It's a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near the landfall point of the eye. A A cubic yard of seawater weighs approximately 1,700 pounds. As this water is constantly slamming into shoreline structures, even well-built structures quickly get demolished. As the waters move inland, more debris floats along with it, causing further damage. Storm surge is responsible for nearly 90% of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. Fact, 1876, Bakergunj, India, 200,000 died, most of them drowned. Fact, 1881, Haiphong, China, 300,000 died. You also have wind damage. The force of wind can quickly decimate the tree population, down power lines and utility poles, knock over signs, and may be strong enough to destroy some homes and buildings. Flying debris can also cause damage, and in cases where people are caught outdoors, injuries and death. When hurricanes first make landfall, it's common for tornadoes to form, which can cause severe localized wind damage, and in most cases, however, wind is a secondary cause of damage. Storm surge is the primary cause. And then, of course, rainfall and flooding. Torrential rains that normally accompany a hurricane can cause serious flooding, whereas the storm surge and high winds are concentrated near the eye. The rain may extend for hundreds of miles and may last for several days, affecting areas well after the hurricane has diminished. And that's what you're going to see with this hurricane. It stalled over New England, and even though the winds dissipated, the rain came in torrents. If you look at the American coastline, very vulnerable. A great deal of the population runs from Boston down to Philadelphia, and the population migrates towards the coast. It's the most sought after land. Here's one of my favorite slides of hurricanes. 100 years of hurricanes, 1896. You can see they developed off the west coast of Africa, and they track to the northwest, and then they hook back out to the northeast. But you can see where the pattern where most hurricanes have cut right across the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, even England, Scotland are vulnerable to hurricanes. GH-38 dies out right here. And not many people realize, but Nova Scotia is in the path of hurricanes to hook out to the northeast. If you look at intense New England hurricane strikes of antiquity, an analysis of sedimentary deposits reveal major hurricane strikes along the New England coast, 1100 to 1150, 1300 to 1400, 1400 to 1450, and of course Columbus came over, he lucked out when he crossed the Atlantic during hurricane season. He had a nice ride across. And then 1635, 1815, and then 1869, I call that Saxby's Gale, that should also be classified as a major hurricane. The Great Colonial Hurricane took place on August 16, 1635, that's the old Julian calendar date, and Governor John Winthrop said, quote, "It blew with such violence with abundance of rain that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams. The ship Angel Gabriel was also destroyed with all hands lost, 21 souls lost." We know that the eye passed to the south and east of Boston, as did GH-38. And William Bradford, in Plymouth at the time, said, quote, "It caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 foot right up and down and made many of the Indians to climb into trees for their safety." Storm surge. "It continued about 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." And he was right. And of course, some attributed to an astronomical phenomena. The moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after. 1815 was the Great September Gale. Saturday, September 23rd, 1815. How ironic is that, that the Great Hurricane took place on September 21st, 1913. Noah Webster said, quote, "The storm was a proper hurricane. It was one of several severe storms that struck North Atlantic shipping lanes that season, and it struck Long Island near Center Mauritius. Montauk Point Lighthouse was heavily damaged, and in the East River, wharves were underwater by 3 feet at 10 in the morning. The eye passes to the east of Hartford and Springfield, as did GH-38. Hampshire Gazette said it was a tornado of wind and rain. In Yale, in New Haven, Connecticut, 6.5 inches of rain over 2 days. That's nothing compared to what we experienced in March. And New Haven Register said that it drifted several hogshead of rum and molasses from the wharf. Important supplies. In eastern Connecticut, all of Rhode Island and east central Massachusetts was raked. The rain had a salty flavor to it. And houses and trees had a white hue from the ocean froth. And the wind whipped 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. And I found 2 uncorroborated reports of a waterspout, on the Charles River during the Great September Gale of 1815. If you look at some major 20th century New England hurricanes, Great Hurricane of 38, the Great Atlantic Hurricane of 1944 and 1954, we're going to talk about that later, Carol, Donna, Edna. So if you look at the track of a hurricane, begins, as most hurricanes do, off the west coast of Africa, tracks almost due west, breaks to northwest, and then moves up the coast. It's known as an extratropical cyclone. And as I mentioned, as the eye wall diminishes, the duration of the storm is prolonged. It just sat over New England. And you can see where it hooked over the Great Lakes. It died over here into Canada. If you look at the timeline, well, it starts off September 18th. It's to the northeast of Cuba, okay? And then the next day, 24 hours, it's just moving slowly. Again, tracking to the north-northwest. And then as it gets off the coast of Florida on September 20th, 8:30 in the morning, a day later it's off Hatteras at 8:30 in the morning, and then it's hitting New York at 3:30, so it's moving 7 hours. It moves 700 miles or 600 miles. And you can see the timeline here from the 10th all the way to the 21st. And it's amazing. It begins as a tropical storm on the 10th. Go Cat 1, Cat 2, Cat 3, Cat 4. Just off the coast of Cuba on the 19th, it's a Category 5. It's a one-eyed monster. And then on the 20th, the day before it hit New England, it's a Category 4 with 155-mile-per-hour winds. And then it hits New England at a 3. I call it a 3.5, between a 3 and a 4. That's what I estimate when it hit New England. Factoids. As I mentioned, the most costly disaster in U.S. history up to that year. It moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour and moved 700 miles in 12 hours. Landfall winds at 127 miles per hour. Some were sustained at 121 miles per hour. That's a big blow. Top winds at 156 miles per hour. At the Blue Hills, just up the street in Milton, 186 mile per hour wind gust. There were a 40-foot storm surge in some places. And it hit at high tide, and the sea rose 17 feet in some places. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, 120 miles away from the ocean. Southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes completely blown off. And the first impact of the storm surge registered on seismographs in Alaska. And seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. Various communities here from Long Island, New York, all the way through Connecticut River Valley that suffered the consequences. You'll see a flood picture later of Peterborough, New Hampshire. Let's look at that summer of 38. Some of you were around then. Record precipitation took place in June and July. It was a muggy August, a really muggy September. From September 12th through the 5th and the 15th, they got 1 inch of rain each day. The rivers were rising. From September 17th through the 20th, there was constant rain. On September 20th, the heaviest rainfall, this is before the hurricane, and 13 inches of rain fell in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. Some areas reported 17 inches of rain in 5 days. So what do you have? You have soft soil, weak foundations, and the roots for the trees, so the hurricane's impact will be exacerbated. And if I could just move forward in time, in 1941, one of the lectures I do, there was a great Brent Rock fire in April of 1941, burned out most of coastal areas of Marshfield. And a lot of the forests in Massachusetts on that day, due to the dry conditions, all the trees that were down from GH-38 served as kindling wood. And there were fires, 200 reported throughout Massachusetts on April 20th and 21st, 1941. So let's look at the newspaper on that day, if you picked it up that day. September 21st, 1938, the Treaty of Munich is imminent. Chamberlain hands over the Sudetenland to Czechoslovakia, over to Hitler through annexation. That noodle, Chamberlain. Churchill, of course, protests. The Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remain 11 games back in the American League. Weather report, Lowell Sun. The weatherman says more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday. Wrong. And of course, irony, drips. A New York Times editorial the day the hurricane hits New York says, every year an average of 3 such whirlwinds sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1933, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world would have been so well informed about the cyclone, it is because of an admirably organized meteorological service. Not correct. Well, they had no tools, okay? It's amazing that I can mow my lawn up until 5 minutes before the rain starts because I can get onto the Doppler radar and find out where the front is. But at Washington, in the Weather Bureau, a 28-year-old rookie by the name of Charlie Pierce, filling in for two vacationing meteorologists, argues that the storm would be sandwiched between two high-pressure systems and head directly north through New England. There was a bowling alley, as he called it. Well, longtime veteran Charles Mitchell of the Weather Bureau, he ignores this forecast and he says, "No hurricane has hit New Jersey during my tenure, and the current storm is weakening." A barometric nosedive. The RMS Carinthia had a reading of 27.85, the lowest in recorded history in the North Atlantic off the coast of Virginia, early in the morning of September 21st. On Fire Island, within 2 hours, it went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low of 27.43 on the 21st of September. My favorite story. On September 21st, a man on West Hampton Beach thought that his new barometer was broken when it measured 28. While he was at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. The father of typhoons. On the Red Star liner Konigstein, skipper Alfred Leidig has a barometer reading of 28.40 with 100 mile per hour winds. On September 19th, Reverend Ernest Gerzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, bound for New York City, states that one of my children would be around in about 3 days. This is after he checked his weather charts and barometric readings and the sky conditions. New York City. Well, the average gale of 65 mile per hour winds hit as a tropical storm. 4.5 inches of rain fell. The city was at a standstill from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Thousands were marooned in office buildings. There was extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45 that night, a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who abandoned the stalled car, given a ride by a kind driver. He got out and was carried away by the current. At Fort Schuyler Road and Throgs Neck, they had 9-foot waters at 7:30 p.m. And here we have the storm's first heroes. J. Gilbert Finning, age 40. William Billy McGrath, age 30. During the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, Finning slips and falls while pushing an elderly woman in a boat. McGrath goes after him. They both perish. McGrath is posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. So if you look at now Long Island, and again, this was dubbed the Long Island Express, the vulnerability of the coast along Long Island. It was devastated, ripped up. Many, many trees knocked down. We're going to look at that later on how many trees they estimate were felled. There were acts of selfishness. Some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account has a family and friends packed into a car that drove off with their servants watching an ankle-deep rising water on the driveway. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves and subsequently drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer saying, "That car is brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" And of course, there was substantial looting, which I'm sure will be admitted into the Olympics as a national American sport sometime. East Hampton, New York. The ground around our house had become so soggy from the rain, nearly all of our tall trees had been uprooted. East Hampton, New York, a devastated village in southern Long Island. West Hampton, Long Island, 28 dead, 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses were destroyed. Trees fell like tenpins along the highway. The Long Island Expressway was blocked off and bottled up. Bridgehampton, New York, devastated. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast during this hurricane, 3,500 trees were lost alone in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. The elms and locust trees that formed a half-mile-long arch over Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. Nassau, Long Island. Dune Deck, Bayside, New York. The ocean torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke on lawns 1 mile inland. Quogue, Quag, anybody want to offer up another pronunciation of it? Corrected by New Yorkers on that. Fire Island, New York. We saw that earlier on the map. It's a very thin peninsula, a very thin stretch of island, a strait. Well, 6 miles south of Bayshore, across Great South Bay, Saltaire lost 125 houses. Kismet, Fair Harbor lost 91 houses. Oak Beach, 29 houses. And Ocean Beach and Point of Woods were also wrecked by this hurricane. Fire Island, Long Island. The day before, over 200 homes had been perched on dunes 20 feet high. The next day, it was just a spit of sand. Frederick Foster Durant. He's 54 years old, the vice president of Fulton Trust Company. He's taken the New York train when he's marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. A 15-minute trip takes 2 hours. He gets home by 8 o'clock. And as he washes up for dinner, as his wife is making dinner, he drops dead from exhaustion and exposure. Have you seen my mummy? At Saltaire, the morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sat on a box. As Chief Assistant DA Lindsay Henry arrived, she asked, "Could you assist us in the search for a body?" "Of course, little girl," he said. "Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly and sadly said, "My mother's." Heroes. West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller and Officer Timothy Robinson saved 17 people. Halfway across the West Bay Bridge, they abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They saved a helpless woman and her 3 children in deep water on Dune Road. They led all 17 onto the roof of a house. A huge wave swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, they landed Quogue, having crossed the bay, and no lives were lost. You're going to see another story about that. People that ride flotsam across the bay. And this is it. The Flight of the Burghards. And bear with me, I'll drive the narrative off the screen. I could use all sort of emoticons and GIFs, but... George and Mabel, the Burghards, and their fox terrier, Bitsy, and their cocker spaniel, Peter, with their caretakers, Carl and Selma Dalen, I said Dalen, not Palin, rented a cottage 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from Coast Guard Station. The distance to the water's edge is about 200 feet, so they're right up on the water. Their neighbors have a 30-foot cabin cruiser that's moored to the dock between their houses, so there's the little inlet. 10 o'clock in the morning. The wind is strong from the north. It's overcast. There's drizzle, and the seas are heavy. An hour later, at 11 o'clock, the wind shifts to the east, then to the northeast, blowing at gale force. Then Dalen reports, this is the servant, that water is bubbling through the concrete floor of the garage. They thought at first it was salt, it was fresh water from the bay, but then they tasted it. It was salt water. Mabel goes upstairs and puts on her swimsuit. Noontime, the neighbor's boat is drifting. Burghardt calls Chief Botsman's mate, James Ketchum, at Mauritius Coast Guard Station, 3 miles to the west of their location. And what's Ketchum say? "I'll be right down." 1 p.m., radio station WESF with a news bulletin. "We interrupt this broadcast to tell you that the West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic. It's right on top of them." Electric power at this point is still on. At 1:30 p.m., a friend of theirs, of the Burghardts, Bill Ottman, calls and says that his garage has just been blown out into the bay. 2 o'clock, 90-mile-per-hour winds are shifting to the east. The water is now 2 feet deep in the garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen suggests that she change her seat. Just as she does, the window blows out with glass shards spread everywhere. Half hour later, 2:30 p.m., the wind and the rain intensifies, and then their bathhouse is swept away. No toilet. 3 p.m., Burghardt tells Dalen to pack up the clothes and move to the third floor. At 3:10 p.m., a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off of his feet. At 3:30 p.m., John Avery, a Coast Guard man, comes across the meadow. "Let's get moving quick, people. No time to lose. Let's get out of here." High tide was due at 6:10 p.m. Burghardt stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills the following day into his pocket. 4 o'clock, Mabel Bernhardt picks up Peter, and George picks up Bitsy. They got their dogs. The Daylands, who are much older, are now dilly-dallying. The wind is now up over 100 miles per hour, and there's a half-mile walk that they have to make to the bridge across the bay. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery. Meanwhile, old Carl clings to a fence post back on the driveway as the group moves down the road. Can you imagine not having to leave your spouse behind? Carl then sits down, and imagine trying to walk in that wind, blowing in your face. That'll exhaust anybody in the most fittest condition. He can't make it through this wind coming directly at him. So he sits down on the fence, exhausted, with his head down. Now he's lagging 75 feet behind the party. And he can't hear their call due to the wind. Mrs. Dalen is hysterical for her husband. The wind suddenly shifts to the southeast at 110 miles per hour. 50-foot breakers roar over the dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents. And there's a boat tied to the dock, and they move toward it. 4:15 p.m., with a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps in the boat. Their only salvation is dragged out to sea. Electrical wires hit the ocean in puddles, so electrocution is a distinct possibility. Mrs. Dalen now is trailing the group. She's now 50 feet behind, refusing to move as she calls for her husband, who's now 125 feet behind the group. The Bernhardts, with their dogs under their arms, go out in a broken dock, and they lie down, hoping to ride it like a surfboard. Just then, a large flat piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Coast Guardsman Avery climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across to the mainland with such force that about 200 feet, the bay bottom was dry. So the storm surge has actually moved so far inland, it's created a dry basin in the bay for 200 feet. The Dalens at this point are helpless. The Bernhardts and Avery jump off the board and wait for a giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. 6-foot waves continually wash them off the board and they climb right back on. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass, and boards with nails moving quickly by them. The dogs are then placed on a trailer little raft behind theirs. Bitsy's washed off, but Peter grabs him by the ear and drags him back to the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly by backwards at 40 miles per hour. The raft is then grounded in berry bushes. They're safe, but Bitsy disappears in the brush. They land 1 mile west from their house at Onek, across the bay, and head to higher ground at the golf course. They wave down a police car and make their way into West Hampton, and Avery says, "My job's done here," and he moves off to help more people. Some of their personal belongings are found miles away from their house. The Dalen's bodies, when they're located, Carl's found near the golf course, ironically where they landed, and he had broken his leg. He's dead. John Avery is cited for bravery, and Wood is found pierced through wood like an arrow. Every street corner has an armed man looking for looters. And there was 48-hour price gouging with unimaginable prices for groceries. There's that selfishness motive. And that awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Whoa, New York, before and after. The gymnasium is now a makeshift mortuary. The breach at Shinnecock Inlet. Shinnecock Inlet before, Shinnecock Inlet afterwards. The storm just punched a hole right to it, as it remains to this day. We saw that off Cape Cod. Change the whole currents in the bay. And then the heroes of Stony Point. 60 colonies of beavers from the Adirondacks built 60 dams. About 500 beavers we're talking about. The dams in Palisades Park held back swollen rivers and ponds, and these beavers worked all through the night of the hurricane to fortify the bulwarks. Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, and stones and sod. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, and it held fast, only spilling 18 inches of water over its top. Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide and water rose 2 feet. What these beavers did is they saved 5 arterial highways that were used for evacuation. Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highways 617 and Route 9 West, the heroes, then, of Stony Point. The plight of the Park City. A ferry left Port Jefferson, New York at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for a 2-hour run to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Captain Ray Dickerson tried to turn back, but the wind shift forced him to drop and drag anchor. Rogue waves filled the hold with over 5 feet of water. At 3:15, fires under the boilers went out, stopping the steam engine and stopping their progress cold. The anchor finally caught at 7:30 p.m. as the crew bailed out the engine room. Most of the passengers sat in their cars for the entire night. Has anybody taken the Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard ferry? Imagine being on board that thing for a whole night with the pitch, the roll. It was a 21-hour odyssey, 2 hours with the Gilligan, Skipper, and Marianne. The Ruth R was blown from Montauk to Block Island and spent 18 hours adrift. There are many, many stories of people caught at sea. One of the stories is a chicken farmer in Long Island had just spent the afternoon 20th tagging his chicken and banding them. One of the chickens is found in Connecticut. Now we move on to Connecticut. The southeast coast is slammed from Saybrook Point to Stonington. Oh, that's a good one. This is the lecture in itself. The Bostonian is a train that has 275 passengers, returning many students to prep schools. It also had business people. Well, as the Bostonian came onto the tracks, you can see it listing, losing some cars. Some of the people had just been served dinner and refused to move. The conductor smashes the fire axe glass and raises the axe. Now you want to move? And he moved everybody up to the front of the train. And the kids were out of control. But it's 3:30 p.m. and the railroads are ordered to halt. And the train fireman checks the tracks. He gets out and he's wading in waist-deep, gets to chest-deep water to the signal. Gets to one of the signal lamps up here. Another guy dives underneath. Holding his breath, it took him multiple times to dive underneath and uncouple the cars that were listing here. Suddenly, a 30-foot sailboat smashes into the train, and 160 passengers are crammed into the engine and front car. The engineer got the engine moving on the fourth try, and he plowed debris and dragging wires, and one of his men, as I mentioned, dove into the water and managed to uncouple the derailed cars, but he saved many lives when they finally rolled into Stonington Station. Bostonian. Famous picture of a steeple, 120-year-old steeple that was toppled. This is mid-flight in Danielson, Connecticut, one of the most famous pictures of the Hurricane of 38. And now, Katherine Hepburn. We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Well, Kate is considered to be box office poison. She had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. We'll talk about that in a second. And she's with her boyfriend, Red Hammond. So she decided to go out and play golf, and it was very humid and breezy. Well, on the par 3 ninth hole, she scored a hole in one. She finished with her best round ever, an incredible 31 on 9 holes. Afterwards, she and Red went back to the house for a swim, and she stated about the breezy weather and rising surf, something very special was going to happen. Well, their family had an elegant summer house in Old Saybrook since the turn of the century. Her brother Dick was a playwright, screenwriter. He was working on a script, a screenplay. And Kate was waiting to hear if she had got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making Bringing Up Baby earlier in the year, a bust at the box office. The water rose 17 feet high, and Dick and Catherine got the family out as two chimneys crumbled and their guest cottage drifted half a mile away. Family heirlooms were lost in the mud. Later, Dick found his typewriter and scripts perfectly intact. Unfortunately, they never got put up in Hollywood. And days later, when Kate got home, she was on her knees on the beach, some say inebriated, digging in vain for her family's jewelry as Red tugged gently on her shoulders and said, "It's time to leave." The Battle of Colt's Dyke, Connecticut River, Hartford. 1,200 WPA workers, World War I veterans, college students, and volunteers fight to keep 1 million tons out of the south end of the city that was devastated in 1936. The Army engineers say there's a 50-50 chance that the bulwark will hold when the water crests at 28 feet. A plan to dynamite Clark's Dyke should it not hold to save the industrial area. So there are decisions made. Do you save the city and its industry, or do you save the homes? And they chose to save the city and its industry. Whereas, for instance, the Portland Gale of 1898 demolished Provincetown and knocked it off the charts as one of the great fishing ports of America. you'll see another town here destroyed by the hurricane. The arrow up here points to the old Travelers Insurance Tower. The clock on the old State House stopped at 4:10. Mrs. Carl Carlson is driving towards Guilford, Connecticut, and she was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. She picked up a book to read. Just then, a tree came crashing down on her car, killing her instantly. She was reading Gone with the Wind. The river rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his bare hands on Main Street. Frank Pretzall's apple tree was blown over and then later blown upright, and it yielded fruit for a few years after that. In New London, storm surge, 110-mile-per-hour winds, and a great fire. New London burned twice, 1781 with Benedict Arnold when he torched it, and again in 1938, and it was east of the Eye. Look at the devastation ships just crammed together. 1781, yeah, Benedict Arnold burned it to the ground, wharves, homes, churches, courthouse, stores, and then one, this was 1 month before the British surrendered at Yorktown. Well, the glow of the 1938 fire in New London could be seen in the cloudy skies from the Long Island and Rhode Island coasts. GH-38 fire burned dozens of buildings before it burned itself out in the dampness. The wind served as an accelerant, and then the wind served as a firefighter as it turned on itself. The five-masted Marsala blew out of the water onto Sparyard Street, crossed the railroad tracks, and struck the corner of the Humphrey Cornell building, somehow starting a fire with electrical wires, they think, in a flooded basement. And there were other fires, too. I have, if you're interested in hearing about that, you can go to my website, www.ushistory.me, go to the audio archive, and Sally Ryan will give you a marvelous talk about Benedict Arnold burning New London, and she'll also talk about the 1938 New London fire. www.ushistory.me. So, this is reported at 4:30 p.m. All communication went down. Fire department asks ham operators to help by calling out people. The fire department is stretched thin across the city. Embers are blown into Store Green and Pearl Street. Warehouses and the entire lower harbor is ablaze. The conflagration feeds on itself. The Coast Guard is the first on the scene. Then the winds shift. They jump over to John Street. The New London News Company burns. And then another fire starts on Pequot Avenue near the Green Harbor Beach area. All in all, 13 commercial buildings were burned to the ground, and 89 buildings were damaged or destroyed during the storm. And this is New London after the fire. Connecticut coast. In Cheshire, Patrick Joyce is killed when hurled against a brick wall of a prison building. Now, on to Rhode Island. Remember, nobody's warned. Nobody knows this thing is coming. There's picnics all along the coast. And again, I can't include every story about the great hurricane tonight, and I'm sure that you'll relay some stories to me tonight. I took some selected stories. And I chose the plight of the Moore family washed out at Watch Hill. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into the attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore, amazingly, had suffered a heart attack that morning, but managed to board up his house. The roof was ripped off and thrown into the sea, and the entire family jumps into the ad hoc raft. Everybody's doing that. Huge waves crash upon them. Hammerhead sharks follow the raft. Hammerheads are brought up. This hurricane is just bringing all the tropical sea life, including jellyfish, up north, and hammerheads actually follow them. Huge waves, they float clear across the peninsula, then the bay, and they drift into a cove on Barn Island. And on Barn Island, they huddle in an abandoned barn. And they watched the glow that night of the New London fire from Rhode Island. And they're rescued by lobstermen the next day. All 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. It's now a sand dune. If you were to show people Watch Hill today and tell them that there are 39 houses, you couldn't believe it because it just looks like a sand dune. Well, a 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith, 175 people are killed. Napatree Point, Rhode Island, Watch Hill, before, after. That's one of the most telling photographic comparisons you can show about the hurricane. And let that be a warning to those who live on the coast, exposed to the Atlantic to the south. The storm hit westerly Rhode Island at 3:50 p.m. and 100 people were killed. 194 of 200 homes were destroyed at Misquamicant Beach in Rhode Island. 50 bodies were found washed up in the sand dunes. The Squamicut Beach along the Rhode Island coast, just a pile of boards. Island Park, Rhode Island, 19 dead, 198 out of 200 homes destroyed. In Newport, Rhode Island, the tidal marsh brought all sorts of debris. Conemaugh Beach, Narragansett Bay, another 100 homes are destroyed. Oakland Beach, 100 left homeless. Woman says, my baby has just been blown out of my arms. Jamestown, Rhode Island. Look at the fissure the storm surge brought. 14 people dead in Barrington. The Governor Carr Ferry in Jamestown, Rhode Island, washed ashore. 86 of 100 boats were destroyed on Block Island alone. Block Island suffered tremendous devastation. What were the three things you'd hear from people after the hurricane? Where do I go now? Everything that I own is gone. And of course, the heartbreaking one, I had no insurance. The rats at Brown University, there's an asterisk. I'm not talking about the people who work in the bursar's office there. We all hear about how animals supposedly react before earthquakes and in time of weather. Well, the calls began coming into a couple of local exterminators that mice had infested a woman's dormitory and that rats were seen at the library at Brown University. Were they seeking higher ground at College Hill? Many cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were reportedly moving about in an agitated manner, according to residents of Plymouth. Providence, the city's a perfect funnel and aqueduct. The storm surge struck at 5:15 just as power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River and a deluge of water 13 feet high was seen in city streets. Providence City Hall and the Biltmore Hotel. The Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. That's a storm surge. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. And of course, we're at the tail end of the Great Depression in 1938. Exchange Place, this boat sat there for a little over a week, washed up, canoe. The Monhegan washed ashore, a steamer wedged into a pier in downtown Providence. Wedding Splashers, slam words with wedding crashers. That movie where we pretend that Vince Vaughn is a comedian, and the Owen guy who feels sorry for himself. Joe Fogle and Lorraine Martin, scheduled to get married on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Where's Joe? Cold feet? Uh-uh. He's stuck at Union Station with his family. So 500 refugees of the storm sought shelter from the storm in the hotel. And what did they do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank all the champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock. They're married by candlelight by an anxious minister. And they take a short walk on a smelly, muddy street. The water had receded by 10 o'clock that night to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore Hotel. Personal story. The Mary Poppins of Brant Rock. A 10-year-old boy in Brant Rock, Marshfield, saw that the weather was getting wild late on the afternoon of September 21st, 1938. He decided to heighten the exhilaration of the storm by getting his grandfather's best umbrella out of the closet and climbing up onto the garage roof. He jumps off the roof, thinking that he might fly. As he tumbled to the ground, the umbrella was bent and broken. He received red bottom for his poor judgment. Of course, that boy was my father. The Great Flood of 36 devastated 5 states in March of 36. The Globe says it was no such widespread waves of destruction that swept over New England in the memory of living men. The floods, which followed days of heavy rains, as I mentioned in the onset of this lecture, as many as 100,000 people were displaced and 100 people died. This was taken to Ware, Mass. In Northampton, Connecticut River spills. And the Springfield Police, now we're the Springfield Coast Guard. The Massachusetts South Coast, we weren't in the tail end here, an eyewitness to the storm surge that hit Horse Neck Beach to Buzzards Bay. At 5 o'clock, this is amazing, he actually sees it coming, the storm surge. He says, a long black band is approaching. A solid black wall of water looked like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore with its top being blown off so that it did not curl up and break like an ordinary wave. 30-foot waves at Horseneck Beach. 41 people die in Fall River. Ships, boats, and barges are torn off their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo, blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, 9 cotton mills are destroyed. 10,000 employees are jobless. New Bedford economy would never recover from the storm. Acushnet River rose 11 feet, and 1,500 people were left homeless in Fairhaven. I wouldn't even have guessed that there were 1,500 homes in Fairhaven in 1938. The New Bedford Standard Times, with this quote, very moving. Women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon in the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head. Westport Harbor, flood zone. New Bedford, ruined. Woods Hole, battered. The destruction at Wareham. Look at the top of Torrey. Bourne Bridge, famous picture. Bourne Bridge had only been opened a few years earlier than the hurricane. I think 33 we're talking. The National Guardsmen are on top of a house mourning the loss of a family that lived in that house by the side of the canal. Martha's Vineyard, 25-foot waves were seen at Chilmark. Menemsha, the bridge from Gayhead to Menemsha, wiped off. East Brookfield, just images here from communities throughout New England, Massachusetts, New Bedford, Springfield, East Bridgewater, Mattapoisett, Taunton. No one was spared. Newton, Fairhaven, Wareham, West Brookfield, Mattapoisett, Boston. More devastation, Uxbridge. It's like London during the Battle of Britain here, huh? Downtown Boston, Arlington Street. The Mass State House. Huge tree fell. A lot of great trees that have stood for a century or more gone. Some of these, you can see this is 38. Odds are that they might have been around just after the revolution. Sadly. Hatshell, underwater. Lexington Green. Exeter, New Hampshire. Peterborough, New Hampshire. And then the papers are published. Boston Post, 45 killed in wild hurricane property damage and the millions, hundreds hurt by wreckage. Then the Evening Globe comes out, hurricane dead, 250. Wrong again. Nazi terror reign begins, 322 dead in storm according to the Daily News, 37 in New York. Deaths now 390 according to Daily Record. Boston Herald, storm deaths mount to 515, 100,000 homeless. Factoids of this hurricane. Peak steady winds 121 miles per hour. As I mentioned, 186 mile per hour peak gust at Blue Hills Observatory in Milton. The lowest pressure, although this is debatable, I saw lower numbers, 27.94 on land at Bellport, New York. Peak storm surge, again, I would debate that it was upwards of 20 feet, 17 feet above normal. Peak wave heights, 50 feet in Gloucester. 700 deaths, 600 in New England. 63,000 homeless. 20,000 miles of power wire knocked down. 8,900 homes and buildings destroyed. 3,300 boats lost. 26,000 automobiles lost. 2 billion trees destroyed. The cost in 1938 dollars, $6.2 million. Adjusted to 1998, $15 billion. Now that our dollar's not worth anyone, why don't we double that, call it $30 billion. Shirley Ann Gatz was born at 3:28 p.m. at Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof blew off and flooded the delivery room. At this point, I ask, who here was born on September 21st, 1938? I had a man raise his hand. He was a preemie. He came 4 weeks early due to the low air pressure. Great Atlantic Hurricane, just the track of this, in 1944. This is before they named hurricanes. They started that practice in the 1950s. Edna in 1954, let's just go back, if you notice, it cuts the track, cuts through Boston, you'll see the same track more or less. This one cuts a little east of Boston, right through the Cape Cod Canal, Aetna. Carroll went right up, just like GH-38, right up the Connecticut River Valley. Diane swept the brushed the coast of New England, southern coast. Donna, 1960, again, more or less up the Connecticut River Valley. Some of the great hurricanes, the big one, the 1926 hurricane of Florida. And, of course, Katrina tops them all in terms of damage. So what do you do when the cyclops comes, when the storm comes? Well, scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. Whenever a storm comes, New England cows just moo, and it's a moan. Oh, here we go again. Check the tides, stay away from the beach. When they tell you to leave, you leave. I always see these people that go out and surf during storms. And do not panic in traffic jams. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. Know where the high ground is in your town and neighborhood. Winds will shift. Don't count on the wind blowing constantly in one direction. Of course, if you hear these survival stories, you can always survive without food for 4 or 5 days. It's water that you have. So how can you carry clean drinking water? I know in this day of disposable water bottles, but stay away from downed power lines and, if possible, water containing downed power lines. And be aware that trees and houses can topple in an instant. Don't swim against the current. If you're within 2 miles of the coast, you're vulnerable to storm surge. And as I like to say, if you're a clown, you certainly will drown. This is the 21st century hurricane blast zone. Let's just say, for instance, that this is where the predominantly when northeasters back in on us, nor'easters, for storms. We're hardy souls, and we know how to endure a battering of heavy snowstorms, but this is the blast area. And you can't really conceive that a hurricane would ever move east to west and move a storm surge along the Charles, but this area is vulnerable, especially if a hurricane just skipped over the Cape and headed directly to Boston Harbor. Great books. Yeah, this is a wonderful book. Everett Allen, A Wind to Shake the World. He's a reporter. First day he's in New Bedford, and the first day on the job as a reporter, and he's in New Bedford the day of the hurricane. Wonderful story. This one here, The Great Hurricane by Sheree Burns. I'm a books on tape guy. What a wonderful book on tape if you can get that. Sudden Sea, R.A. Scotty, and Aaron Gutsuzian with another wonderful book here. I have a history festival in Watertown. I call it Historapalooza. A Woodstock for colonial reenactors. I have Ralph Waldo Emerson, John F. Kennedy, Edgar Allan Poe, the Underground Railroad, and the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Company A, etc., etc. So now, my favorite part is I get to hear about your accounts of the Great Hurricane. Does anybody want to talk? Even if you just remember trees blowing, I'd love to hear about it. Does anybody remember the Great Hurricane in 1938? Yes, sir.
I was 6 years old. And I remember my mother had pulled down all the shades in the house and said, stay away from the windows. And I pulled up the shades and I was watching chimneys in the neighborhood fall.
What town?
In Boston, in downtown Boston, in the south end of Boston.
South end, wow.
In fact, just one block from there, the church that we went to, the Holy Trinity, it lost its steeple in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. And again, you didn't know it was a hurricane until after it was over, right? Yes. I've heard all sorts of kids playing, going out there in the exhilaration of the wind. Does anybody else recall the hurricane? Yes.
After the hurricane, my parents took me down to Rhode Island. And Rhode Island was devastated. And we went down near the beach, and in this huge field was all kinds of furniture and bathtubs, everything, all in one spot. And I'm thinking now, how did it get there? And then some friends of ours were in a cottage right on the beach. And they didn't leave the cottage. And they stayed there until the last minute. And some people saw them up on the roof, and the roof was going out to sea. So that's what I remember.
Wow, do you remember what town or island it was?
Well, we were down in West.
Westerly?
No, not Westerly, Miss Plummer.
Okay, well, so you were right there in yeah. The heart of the strike zone.
And then after all these houses were gone on the beach, they didn't allow, they made a law, you couldn't build on that beach again, you made it all state beach.
But it's funny how builders and contractors and homeowners forget about that now because they're right up on the water now.
And,
oh yeah, just along the southern coast of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. There are certain areas that they quarantined off, but there's still many, many areas that are vulnerable to a severe storm as such. Especially, we can endure the nor'easters because they come from the northeast. The winds back us and they move to the west. We know where the wind direction is coming, but when one comes up from the south, it's a whole different ballgame.
But there's another thought I had. When we say it's a hurricane today, would you say that it's part of a tsunami?
It's got nothing to do with tsunamis. Tsunamis are associated with earthquakes. So storm surge is a mini tsunami in a sense because the storm, actually the winds are actually pulling the water with it. When the storm comes, it's taking all the marine life and all the ocean with it, so it raises storm levels. Couple that with a high tide or even double that with a lunar high tide and you've got some big, big problems. But it's not a tsunami, but you saw that gentleman describing the wall of water coming in.
When you said the water was pulled up on the beach and it was dry in one spot, I thought, that sounds like a tsunami.
That,
in reverse.
In reverse, what they're saying is that the wind had blown it so hard, the water. And again, if let's just say, and work with me here, and I'm being extemporaneous, but if the bay is inside the water, and the wind comes from this direction, it's actually, there's no land water to come over the land portion of it, and it just sweeps it the other way. So it made more of the beach area accessible. But it sometimes, like it does appear to be like a tsunami, but it's actually been blown by the wind and the force of the ocean. Poor explanation. Does anybody else have any tales? Yes, sir.
I was 80 years old when the storm. I lived in Rockland. It was at a friend's house on Webster Street. My family always had a tradition. Any storm, we always went to the beach, get the property in Situate. So my father had called me up and said, come outside, wait for me, I'm going to stop by and pick you up and go to the beach. So we did. We had property up on Fourth Cliff, so we didn't have to worry about the tide. I hear it, but came back. Friend's house, they had two large elms, not wet elms, they were maple trees right across from the sidewalk. Both those trees were down right where I had stood away from my father. It was minutes or hours, but it happened.
Yeah.
I hear so many stories like that. Providence, they call that. We spoke about the woman who was sewing in the window of Mabel Burghardt and she was told to move, smash. I've heard, given this lecture dozens of times, I've heard people saying that right as I moved out of the way, the tree fell. As if the unseen hand was there to protect them.
Also, I said, no, they had two great aunts that had a cottage in the Cape. The cottage and the aunts were swept out to sea. There was no sign of freight or anything. It disappeared from the face of the
earth. Where were they?
I don't know what the term was. I was kind of young.
Rhode Island?
No, Cape Cod.
On the Cape Cod?
Yeah, and we didn't talk too much about it.
Wow. And they weren't warned?
Well, we didn't get much warning anyway.
No. Don Kent was one of the few that called it, right?
Right.
Did you remember as a boy hearing it on the radio, or what did you?
Well, I had to be on the radio somewhere.
Did your dad say he just thought it was a storm? He didn't think it was a proper hurricane.
No, I don't think they a storm was coming.
Yeah.
And it
intensified so quickly. And it was on top of you before you could react. So there were people, and there were fishermen that were never heard from again, never.
Right, they just disappeared.
Yeah, and I'm not even talking about what happened to other areas off the coast of the Canadian Maritimes. They, of course, suffered as well with seas. And does anybody else have an account? Yes, sir.
When we experienced hurricanes Diane and Carol, my parents always used to say, you ain't seen nothing.
Really? Wow.
Now I can appreciate it.
Wow. Interesting. And now, you know, your children, grandchildren, you can say, you ain't seen nothing when you talk about Don and some of the great hurricanes in the 1950s. Does anybody else have any questions? Yes.
I was about 5 years old in 1938. We lived in Marion, Weirton area. But my grandfather was a lighthouse keeper at Sandy Point, Prudence Island. Rhode Island, and he lost my grandmother and uncle were washed out to sea, along with the retired people who was visiting, you know, when the house went down. They never found my uncle's body, but they found my grandmother's body on the beach in Newport, and she had been clutching her purse. And someone had come along and snipped off the purse, and she was holding the ambulance.
Wow.
But they never operated that lighthouse again on the Sandy Point Prudence.
May I ask you the distance from Newport to Sandy Point, roughly, you're talking 10 to 12 miles?
I really don't know. Wow.
Heartbreaking. Anybody else have any comments? Well, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure speaking here. I appreciate your time. Thank you.